Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. September 17th this week marked the fourth anniversary of the start of the historic Occupy Wall Street movement, which was born in New York City and spread around the world like wildfire. We turn today to examine that movement with the benefit of hindsight. A book by Michael Gould Wartofsky paints an intimate portrait of the nearly two-month-long encampment in Zuccotti Park, renamed Liberty Square, New York City, providing an insider's view that is informed by deep familiarity with the actors involved. Gould Wartofsky documented the actions in detail. His book is called The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. Michael Gould Wartofsky also writes for The Nation, The Monthly Review, Salon, and Jacobin. Welcome to Uprising.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
Now, your book was based on a large number of interviews that you did with Occupy activists, but also from your own vantage point as a participant in the movement. And I want to begin there. How did your participation inform your writings and observations? You're not writing about it from the outside looking in. In fact, you use the words avowedly partisan to describe your views.
That's right. And my participation also extends back before Occupy and extends after what we call Occupy, and really kind of inform my perspective on how to go about writing this book. I think a lot of the coverage of the movement, both in media and in academia, was at first kind of dismissive and then very interested and then lost interest very quickly. But what I tried to do and what this perspective of partisan observation of embedded inquiry, what that gave me was, I think, a longer term view. So to be able to situate the Occupy moment in a longer arc of mobilization and also to follow the occupiers into exile after the pepper spray and the tear gas had cleared and to try to see what endured after. So I think that the perspective of being someone who was on the ground on September 17th and kind of stayed, at the ground level of the movement, didn't try to kind of look at it from the outside looking in or from the end point looking backward, really framed it for me in a way that that allowed me to tell a different kind of social history than I think in much of my field and in much of social science.
Did you know from the moment that it started that this was going to be historic? And I ask that question because you describe how in the lead up to Occupy Wall Street, of course, it didn't come out of nowhere. There were other gatherings, and you showed up to several of these thinking they would be bigger than they were and left disappointed. And so when the September 17th, 2011 occupation, the encampment began, did you have a sense that this time it would be different?
I didn't. And I thought that the context was different. I was surprised that there hadn't been more resistance and more of a mobilization since the economic crisis hit. And of course, there had been to some extent, but I was curious to see where this one would lead. And at first, it didn't seem like much more than 2,000 people in a park. I didn't realize that it was going to last the night, let alone 2 months, and spread to 900 plus cities around the world, as it had spread from the world to New York City. So I think that's kind of what kept me in it was this was an anomaly. This was something that we hadn't seen on the left in this country for a long time in terms of the convergence of social forces that it made possible, and not just in the parks and the squares and the kind of in front of the cameras, but also in neighborhoods, in workplaces, in schools and universities. So that was something that that proved that this time was different to me.
And there was also a lot happening around the world in the lead up to Occupy Wall Street that we don't often link to what happened in Zuccotti Park. After the recession hit here in the United States, in Wisconsin, there was the uprising there. But then around the world, you saw the revolution in Egypt, the Indignados encampment in Spain. How did those broader movements and social upheavals in other parts of the U.S. and around the world lay the groundwork for Occupy Wall Street?
That's right. And Occupy wouldn't have been Occupy without that wave of mobilizations that was, truly global in scale at that time. And it was a creature of that historical moment. It was a creature of that global evolution in tactics and strategy on the part of a global 99%. So, it started out, of course, with the Arab revolutions and very quickly was taken up by protesters in Wisconsin who tied it to their revolt against the austerity regime there. And then, of course, the all across the Mediterranean that spring, occupations were popping up in places that they weren't expected, like Spain, places that they were, like Greece. And all of those occupations, protests and strikes and the revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa in particular had a demonstration effect on the occupiers that I interviewed in New York City, also in Oakland, Chicago, Atlanta, and other places. And many of them had watched and listened to and learned from the example and took as a source of inspiration and also a source of solidarity for themselves. It went both ways once Occupy Wall Street emerged. So this was truly a creature of a global movement and a moment for those movements all around the world.
Among the most memorable and important messages and slogans that came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement was this idea that we are the 99%. Where did that come from? How crucial was that message, you think, to the success of the occupation?
I do think that that the message that it conveyed was crucial. It could have been, put in different ways, phrased in different ways, but I think that particular framing of the problem and the fundamental dynamic, the conflict between the wealthiest 1% and the rest of us basically was a very effective one. It also, of course, erased some things and obscured some things and raised a lot of questions as well. But it came from poor people's movements. It's been attributed to anarchist academics and to Adbusters, to David Graeber, to various sources. But I found its first usage was actually before all that, before Occupy was even a thing. In March of 2012, and it came out of this occupation of the Capitol building in New York State by a number of poor people's organizations, housing, labor organizations, who were facing the long arm of austerity that was then reaching, all across our state and all across the country. And then it was very quickly taken up by and turned into something that was not just a statistic but a strategy, and a strategy of basically of class struggle in a way that that did not call itself that, but allowed people to see that they shared some of their problems that they were facing with other people who were like them, other people who were not like them, and that they could find some common ground, some common cause in that.
Now, you interviewed a large number of people, about half of whom were those who participated in Occupy Wall Street in New York, and the rest were from four other major cities where the Occupy movement spread to, but also around the world and cities around the world. Tell us about the interviews you did. I mean, that's a lot of data to draw from.
Certainly, and I would have loved to have done more, but I thought that it was important that I put this book out when I did. But the 80 interviews I did, they started out just kind of based in New York City, but I realized I was going to offer a very incomplete picture. Of course, in New York City, we like to think that the world is in New York City, but it required that I speak to people in these seven other cities. So I spoke to people in Oakland and Chicago and Atlanta and Philadelphia here in the United States. And then I spoke as well to people in Athens, London, and Madrid. And of course, I couldn't give a truly global picture. And I tried to be a little bit radically humble as I did this research and be clear about the limitations of what I knew, but also to be able to get some perspective from people on the ground and all these sites of struggle around the world.
You also archived, I understand, the communications of Occupy Wall Street, their posters and flyers, and their internal communications. So why was that important? And what did that tell you about the movement?
Right. So I think that, you know, there are certain things that you can glean from just the visual dimension of these movements by what they produce, by what the kind of materials that they actually produce and that they use to communicate, and then of course what they're communicating, and of course the internal debates were very intense and very sharp, and the only way you could really you know access those various perspectives, and also to try to see what you know how people were being mobilized and how the frame and the message was evolving, was to trace those communications and to cross-check you know the observations that I had made, that other people had made in my interviews with other evidence that I could find, you know, just to give a bigger and a fuller and a clearer picture, because I felt that the movement deserved that.
Now, let's also talk about the fact that when the occupation in New York City in Zuccotti Park began, which was the kind of the seed that spread elsewhere, when that began, it transformed pretty quickly. When it first started, you mentioned there were about 2,000 people, mostly young and white. What did it transform into? Very soon, there was the People of Color Working Group that formed. There were other sort of aspects, and a mini society formed that had many hallmarks of what societies need, you know, to be fed both in mind and through food.
That's right. That's right. You know, those counter institutions in the park and other places that fed people, that clothed people, that sheltered people, that also opened up spaces for them to you know really exercise some degree of control over their own lives for once. I think that you know was part of the mass appeal. Another was that there were these really, really strong connections that were made between the occupiers and people who'd been doing this work for a long time in New York City, and other places like Oakland, that were formed at that time. Another piece of the puzzle that's often left out is the role of the movement, we could say a proto-movement for Black Lives. At that time, the Troy Davis case brought a lot of people out into the streets. That was the first week of Occupy. That was a moment when people converged from the movement for racial justice and the movement for economic equality. Another moment came when people were coming under attack in Zuccotti Park and elsewhere in New York City, and this was broadcast all across the city and across the country. And people came out to defend it and effectively defended it for some time against the forces of the police and of the municipal administration. This was again a moment of convergence, and you know that was kind of part of the power of the thing, and it also was part of what gave it its social base, which was much bigger, I think, than anyone could have anticipated on that day one when most of us were you know some young white kids in a park.
Now, during the nearly 2-month-long occupation, communication between a very, very large group of people and with each other would have been much more cumbersome were it not for the very interesting and unique method of communication developed right from the start, marked by the consensus-style communication where people used hand signals to gesture to one another and echoed each other's words to amplify them, the so-called people's microphone. I mean, you know, in retrospect, it might sound a little bit cheesy, but at the time, how seriously did people take these ways of communicating with one another?
Yes, they took it very, very seriously, and I think you know to those who are watching, listening, who were part of this in your city. This is something that was not just you know adopted enthusiastically in New York City. It was something that worked for people everywhere, you know, across the country. That people's microphone allowed people to speak and to be heard in a way that people normally aren't spoken and heard in our society, especially, you know, those who are most historically oppressed and marginalized, and those voices were echoed across the squares, and that was something that was really powerful. It also it worked as a way of bonding people closer together, as a source of solidarity. It was a source of reflection. You could reflect on the words you were hearing. You were speaking them at the same time. You could also, you know, decide together with a thousand other people what, you know, what you were going to do about it, in a way that made sure that those voices were heard. So, you know, it was a very effective mode of social movement innovation that I think we're still seeing and hearing today.
Let's also talk about how the fact that the Occupy Wall Street encampment went on for nearly 2 months. And during that time, one very important occurrence that took place in the United States was the execution of African-American death row inmate Troy Davis. What impact did that have on the encampment?
So that was really the moment. I would argue that was the moment when it became a movement, a space for movement building and not just for occupying, for organizing and not just for occupying. This was a moment when thousands of people, you know, came out, and millions of people across the country participated in some way in the protest campaign to try to save Mr. Davis's life. And we failed, as we know. And this was also something that showed a lot of people that the system, the whole system, was guilty, as they said. And you know, it was an indictment of the American criminal justice system. At the same time, as a lot of for the first time, as a lot of young white people were feeling just a whiff of you know, what communities of color have been facing in this country for a very long time. And so there was a convergence in the streets that night after we marched for Troy Davis. And it was the first time that Zuccotti Park really started to look more like New York City. And this was also a very important moment for people watching across the country who saw this, that, you know, the bankers who had, you know, destroyed millions of people's lives were walking free. And an innocent man had just been put to death by the state.
Eventually, of course, the New York occupation was dismantled, as happened in other cities as well. But it couldn't have lasted forever, right? It shouldn't have come as a surprise that eventually city authorities would try to end it. And I'm wondering if there were discussions that took place during, at least in New York, during the occupation, where you were a participant, where people could see the long view that may be manifest, you know, of what would happen to something that started out as a physical encampment, but eventually would have to transform into something else.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I argue in the book, the occupation was bound to have a limited half-life. Occupations everywhere, that you can't occupy forever, as you're saying. And, you know, there were all kinds of, there's a very high threshold for participation in a 24-hour occupation. So if you're asking, you know, people with families, people who are struggling to make ends meet, to make that the only tactic available, I think you're also, you know, you're also potentially leaving some people out who could be part of the movement. And you know, the occupation wasn't always going to be there. Some people realized that. And tried to do something about it, and tried to, you know, parlay this into mass organizing, tried to parlay it into Occupy Our Homes, tried to parlay it into efforts to engage more deeply with the political economy, with the structures at, you know, in question. And I think that, you know, there were some things that did endure, that did outlive the occupied squares. But I think it came too little too late in terms of thinking through how this could, you know, this could be channeled, moved, this anger could be moved into something that, you know, would really was built to last.
Finally, Michael, let's talk about Occupy Wall Street's legacy. During Superstorm Sandy in New York, a lot of New York occupiers found a reason to organize. But again, that was sort of transient. And we've covered the strike debt and the debt collective who are organizing, you know, people refusing to pay back student loans, who are calling for free higher education. How would you quantify or characterize the legacy of Occupy Wall Street?
Right. So you see it. I think, you know, everywhere where young people, where workers and students and poor people are working together in a way that they weren't before Occupy Wall Street. Everywhere they're working to leverage whatever power they have, against the power of the 1%, from the fight for 15, which actually there was an effort to organize a fast food workers union by Occupy Oakland even before the institutional unions ever got involved. There was, as you mentioned, there was an effort to have a debt strike. Occupy Sandy, the climate justice movement, the fight for net neutrality, which scored a historic victory recently, and a lot of the momentum around the people of color working groups, really was part of the wave of and the upsurge that we saw in 2012 and 2013 around the Trayvon Martin case, the Million Hoodie March. And eventually the movement for Black Lives. So there was a lot of energy and a lot of action potential in this coalition. And that remained after the authorities did what they did.
My guest has been Michael Gould-Wartofsky. He is the author of The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. You can learn more about his work at michaelgouldwartofsky.com or check our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, for the link. We'll be right back after this break.